Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nick Neihardt of Public Campaign, who discusses the links between America's corrupting pay-to-play big money system of financing elections and the deregulation of Wall Street that led to the nation's current economic crisis. Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who assesses President Obama's Iraq withdrawal plan and the role of the peace movement in pressuring the new administration for a more rapid exit. And Ashley Nellis of the Sentencing Project, who describes the dangerous conditions faced by young people convicted and sentenced to life without parole for crimes committed when they were under the age of 18. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Obama administration is putting the final touches on its overhaul of strategy for Afghanistan, including inserting a powerful prime minister in Kabul. With the support of European allies, plans for naming a new chief executive in the Afghan capital would undermine the authority of President Hamid Karzai, reports the Guardian newspaper. Karzai, who is running for re-election in August, has fallen out of favor with Western powers over his failure to clamp down on corruption and drug cartels. The Obama policy review regarding Afghanistan and Pakistan is nearly complete and set to be laid out at a special conference on March 31st. Among the recommendations will be to more than triple the size of the Afghan army and expand the national police force. Western donor nations are also looking to bypass national ministries in Kabul and funnel aid directly to provincial governments. The policy review will also reset expectations for Afghanistan. The key goal will be to defeat the Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters while de-emphasizing establishment of a Western-style democracy. Recent attention has focused on Hamid Karzai's brother, Mahmoud, who despite limited business experience is now a real estate tycoon in Kabul and also owns a large stake in the country's largest bank. In the last few years, Afghanistan was rated one of the most corrupt countries on earth by the watchdog group Transparency International. On his first trip to Africa, Pope Benedict sparked outrage with his comment that condoms can damage the fight against AIDS. The Pope's comment, made during his flight to Cameroon, was attacked by public health workers, AIDS doctors, and even the French Foreign Ministry, who called the Pope's criticism of condoms to prevent AIDS a danger to public health policy. Rebecca Hodes of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa said Pope Benedict's opposition to condom use suggests religious dogma is more important to him than the lives of Africans. According to the Guardian newspaper, two-thirds of those infected globally with HIV live in sub-Saharan Africa. In his comments to the media, Pope Benedict was restating the Vatican view that condoms were not helpful in the fight against AIDS. Catholics now make up 17% of all Africans and are battling for the allegiance of religious Africans with Islamic groups and evangelical Protestants, who all have strong, socially conservative views on human sexuality. Conservative activists are attempting to use the election of President Barack Obama as a rationale for rolling back protections in the Voting Rights Act. Right-wing groups claim the United States has become a colorblind society in challenging provisions of the Voting Rights Act before the U.S. Supreme Court, which in recent decisions has restricted use of the civil rights-era legislation. Voting rights activists maintain that discrimination is still a problem at the ballot box, with stark racial polarity in states covered by the Voting Rights Act. A study of the 2008 election showed Obama won only 10% of white votes in Alabama and Mississippi, far fewer than won by John Kerry, a white Democrat, in 2004. Recently, in a narrow 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that states and municipalities only need to consider race when redrawing voting districts when blacks or Latinos make up a majority of a district's population. Speaking from the bench in early March, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy stated, "Racial discrimination and racial polarization are not ancient history. much remains to be done to ensure that citizens of all races have an equal opportunity to share and participate in our democratic process and traditions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Outraged over the $165 million in bonuses paid to employees of insurance giant AIG, recipient of over $180 billion in U.S. government bailout funds, some critics called for the arrest of those involved. In a recent television appearance, President Barack Obama noted that most of what the big banks and investment houses did with subprime mortgage-backed securities and credit default swap derivatives that triggered the current economic crisis was perfectly legal. And it's true that deregulation of the nation's financial institutions, legislated by Congress, is the key to understanding why the economy now finds itself in the worst downturn since the Great Depression. The enormous amounts of money flowing directly and indirectly from Wall Street firms to U.S. representatives and senators played a direct role in influencing legislators to dismantle long-standing regulations designed to avert the financial disaster seen after the stock market crash of 1929. Over the past 10 years, Wall Street companies spent more than $5 billion to influence Congress, with $1.7 billion going to federal candidates, parties, and political action committees. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nick Neihardt, co-founder and president of Public Campaign, which has for years been an advocate for public financing of electoral campaigns at the state and federal level. Neihardt examines the links between America's corrupting pay-to-play big money system of financing elections and the nation's current economic crisis. He also discusses a new bill, the Fair Elections Now Act, that would create a voluntary public campaign financing system that would ban contributions from lobbyists and place strict limits on other sources of campaign cash.
Over the course of two decades, the financial sector put $5 billion into lobbying Congress and also into campaign contributions. And over the course of the 90s and in this decade, Congress really didn't give Wall Street that much oversight and deregulated the financial sector. And when people look back and say, what should we have done differently, I think there's a lot of agreement there should have been greater regulation of Wall Street and not less. But Congress basically looked the other way and relaxed these restrictions, and at the same time could count on Wall Street funders for a huge amount of money for their reelection campaigns. So you have a great example of Congress not being able to do its job because it relied heavily on campaign contributions from the very people that they were supposed to regulate. And here's the scary thing. When you look over the two decades and ask yourself, in which of these 10 two-year cycles did the financial sector give the most money, it was this most recent one. So the Wall Street influence question is one that's sitting out there right now. And I think when you look at the what some would say is a tin ear that lawmakers in Washington have had about the bailouts and about the idea that executives from bailed out companies would still receive huge bonuses, part of that tin ear is because they've been so immersed in a dialogue with the sector they're trying to regulate that ordinary citizens' voices who are very outraged just get filtered out. And what we think ought to happen is that candidates ought to rely on people in their home districts and in their home states for their campaign money, and we've devised a way to do that. And that way they wind up listening first and foremost to their constituents.
There's a lot of outrage, of course, about these AIG bonuses, and there's enormous focus and attention on that in the U.S. corporate media. But it is a distraction to some extent from what the real problem is and what the real solutions are. Do you think people are connecting the dots between the influence Wall Street has on their congressperson, on their senator, and how these pieces of deregulation legislation went into effect?
Yes. I mean, I don't think people track the details of financial regulation, but I think they do know that they're not to blame. Ordinary people are not to blame for the fiscal crisis we're in now. And we did a poll recently, a nationwide poll with some other reform groups like Common Cause and Public Citizen, and we asked people to agree or disagree with this statement. I'm worried that large political contributions will prevent Congress from tackling the important issues facing America today, like the economic crisis, rising energy costs, reforming health care, and global warming. And more than three-quarters of the voters, 79%, agreed with that statement, and most of them strongly. So people do connect the dots, and I think they feel like their political leaders are letting them down and paying more attention to the people who give them their money than the citizens who they were elected to serve. So folks get it. They may not get the intricacies of the kinds of campaign finance reform you might need to pass to change that, and they probably couldn't tell you in detail what kind of regulatory policy would work, but they know they want a better deal, and they know they're not getting served well by the current political system.
A coalition of groups, including yours, is proposing what's called the Fair Elections Now Act, and it's going to be introduced in both the House and Senate this month. You want to say a word about what the legislation is and the chance it has of getting passage?
Under the Fair Elections Act, that's going to be proposed later this week by Senators Durbin and Specter, and in the House by Congressman John Larson from the greater Hartford area, candidates who want to run under public financing would collect a large number of small contributions, contributions ranging from $5 to $100. They would raise $50,000 in small contributions, none more than $100, and then get a grant of public financing for the primary, and if they win the primary, another grant for the general. And in total, it would give them roughly the average, actually a tiny bit more beyond what candidates running for Congress, winning candidates, now spend. But when those races cost more, there's got to be a way for a candidate to raise more money. And under our system, they can continue raising money in contributions of $100 or less, and that money is matched 4-to-1. And that way, if you're in a tight race, you have to turn to people in your home state for more money instead of going out and having a fundraiser in Beverly Hills or on Wall Street. So the idea is that we turn the current system on its head.
Nick Neihardt, when you look at the forces arrayed against public financing, I'm sure among that group are wealthy corporations and other bodies that have used with great success their wealth to influence how legislation runs on Capitol Hill. Maybe you could name some of the groups and other coalitions that you know will be opposing public financing.
Well, I certainly think the Chamber of Commerce is one, and the National Association of Manufacturers are organizations that might be against this. But frankly, I think they're going to have their hands full on a lot of other issues. And we found increasingly business leaders who have given large contributions are getting sick of this system. They feel like they're being told, I won't listen to your company's point of view unless you give me money. And so a lot of them would also rather be out of the fundraising game and making the case for their business on the merits.
That was Nick Neihardt, co-founder and president of Public Campaign. Contact the group by calling area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at publiccampaign.org. President Barack Obama's February 27th announcement detailing his plan to withdraw most U.S. combat forces from Iraq by August 2010 and all remaining troops by December 2011 was met with disappointment by many activists in the American peace movement. What upset many was the president's plan to leave 35,000 to 50,000 troops behind to train and advise the Iraqi military and engage in unspecified anti-terrorist operations. Disturbingly, some U.S. generals have stated they believe U.S. forces should remain in Iraq past the December 2011 deadline agreed to by former President Bush and the Iraqi government. The president's deployment of an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan further angered anti-war activists. Although violence has made a dramatic decline in Iraq in recent months, there has been a recent upsurge in the number of suicide bombings and signs of restiveness by former Sunni insurgents on the U.S. payroll. Most of the Sunni resistant fighters now receiving payment in American dollars, known as the Sons of Iraq, have not yet received jobs promised to them within Iraq's military, police, and government. On the sixth anniversary of the war, more than 100,000 Iraqi civilians have died, 4,200 U.S. servicemen and women have lost their lives, and over $657 billion has been spent. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, the nation's largest anti-war coalition. Kagan assesses President Obama's Iraq withdrawal plan and the role of the peace movement in pressuring the new administration for a more rapid exit from both Iraq and Afghanistan. She also describes an upcoming protest action scheduled for April 4th on Wall Street in New York City.
The good news is that we now have a president that actually has a plan in relation to Iraq. But of course, before we had a president with no plan. The plan was shock and awe 6 years ago, and an ongoing war and occupation and death and destruction. So now we have a president that has announced a plan to withdraw. The bad news in all this is that the plan takes so long to bring the troops home. So while we're glad that there is a plan, we're not happy with the details of the plan. Of course, no one expects that size force and all of their equipment could come home overnight. But we believe if the political will was there, all of our troops could be out of Iraq, safely out of Iraq, back home in a much, much shorter time frame. And so our work as an anti-war movement in relation to Iraq is certainly far from over. The other concern we have, which we need to mention here, is that we're deeply troubled by the president's idea to send more troops into Afghanistan. We don't want to just substitute a war in Iraq for a war in Afghanistan. And, in fact, the war in Afghanistan has already been going on. Each year the situation there gets worse, not better. And so that history alone, let alone the longer centuries of history in relation to Afghanistan, should tell the policymakers in Washington that a war there is not going to be the way that whatever problems we're trying to solve, they're not going to get solved by a war. So we're very alarmed by the president's decision, which he announced shortly after taking office, that he wants to send 17,000 more troops into Afghanistan, and what will come next? When will more troops be sent? So we're working now on these two fronts, that is, to try and bring that timeline around Afghanistan into a much shorter range and to prevent an escalation of the war in Afghanistan and, in fact, work to bring those troops home as well.
Within the peace movement in the United States, there's been some criticism that certain elements of the peace movement are going to go easy on Obama because they're so happy to have Bush out of office and are somehow in sync and in line with the Democratic Party's line of the day. You want to respond to that and just give your own position on how hard-edged you think the peace movement should be with Barack Obama?
Right. Well, let me just say, I think probably the vast majority of the people of the world, not just the people of this country, he's a tremendous sigh of relief on Election Day. Having said that, we also need to be honest with ourselves and with each other that the Obama presidency will not be able to, even if they want to, they will not be able to overnight or very quickly make the kind of changes we want, especially if we sit back. So I think it is possible, it has to be possible, to both be happy to see the Bush era done and over, but also remain vigilant in our work. People are suffering under bad policies that still exist, and until they change, they haven't changed. So, as we start to say, the war in Iraq isn't over until it's over, and therefore our work is far from over.
On April 4th, your group and others around the country are going to be organizing a protest in New York City. I know that centers around Wall Street, and it falls on the anniversary of a speech made by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. about why he opposed the Vietnam War back at New York City's Riverside Church. You want to tell our listeners about what is being planned for Wall Street in New York on April 4th?
Sure. I'm really glad you raised that. On April 4th, which is a Saturday, people will be gathering. It is, as you said, the anniversary of Dr. King's really historic speech Beyond Vietnam, where he really laid out his understanding of how war and poverty and racism are all connected, and that dealing with one means dealing with all of them, and the urgent need to make those connections. And then, of course, it was just a year later to the date, April 4th, 1968, when he was in Memphis making those connections. He was there to support striking sanitation workers, where he was shot down. He was assassinated and killed. So we chose that date to organize another demonstration to go to Wall Street to say, first and foremost, again, the wars and the occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan have to end. They are, in addition, above and beyond the human cost of the war, which is, you know, continue to mount every day, the economic costs of this war are one of the factors that has led this country to this economic crisis. It certainly is not the only factor, may not even be the most important factor, but it is a contributing factor when well over $600 billion has already been drained from our economy, from our national treasury, and poured into these wars, you know, that never should have happened, and then look at our own communities. So we decided it was time by our actions, by where we actually marched, to make these connections, just as Dr. King was making 40-something years ago. And so we are marching on Wall Street.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact the nationwide coalition of peace groups by calling area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at unitedforpeace.org. Among the more than 2.1 million Americans behind bars, more than 2,000 were convicted and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for crimes committed when they were under the age of 18. Some, but not all, of these juveniles begin serving their sentences in youth facilities, but they will eventually be transferred to adult prisons. They are entitled to additional services because of their age, but often are treated the same as adults. These young prisoners face the additional risk of exploitation and rape. Studies indicate a pronounced racial disparity for youths receiving harsh sentences. African Americans have been found to be overrepresented in the juvenile, life without parole population in nearly every state. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ashley Nellis, senior researcher at the Sentencing Project, who recently completed a survey of juveniles held around the country who have been sentenced to life without parole. She describes some of the conditions these inmates encounter inside prisons and explains how some youth receive harsh sentences even when they are convicted of being accessories to murder.
It's been an escalating problem, the sentencing of juveniles to life without parole for several years is sort of an unfortunate consequence of two bad crime policies, one being the transfer of juveniles to the adult system, and then also the implementation of mandatory minimums, one of which is life without parole for certain crimes, so that in many of the cases that juveniles find themselves with a life sentence without parole is because they've been transferred to the adult system and then are subject to a mandatory life without parole sentence that by law can't look at their age as a mitigating factor.
What kind of things did you find when you broke the data down demographically?
It's probably no surprise that African Americans are highly overrepresented in the juvenile life without parole population in, you know, in nearly every state, and in some places it's particularly egregious. And it's also highly concentrated in states that use felony murder rule as a way of sentencing children to life without parole, which means that they were not directly involved in the crime but were present during a felony in which a homicide took place.
In November, the Connecticut Supreme Court took up the appeal of a juvenile who was sentenced to life without parole and ruled that it is not cruel and unusual punishment. The decision quoted the U.S. Supreme Court decision banning the execution of juveniles to make that very distinction. Have other states filed similar appeals? Do you know?
I know that Alabama has raised several legal challenges, as has Illinois and Michigan, and I'm sure efforts have been underway in other state courts, and it's usually along those same lines that it's considered to be cruel and unusual punishment. There are many who argue that life without parole for a juvenile is no different than a sentence of death, and the Supreme Court has held that juveniles can't be executed anymore, and because of the cruel and unusual, and the idea that because of their less developed brain that they are categorically less culpable for the crimes that they have committed. And in many instances, these children who do admittedly gruesome acts in many cases are coming from places that are far different than many other kids. They often come from severely abused and neglected homes. They've watched violence all their lives, and to commit a violent act is not so out of the ordinary. And they haven't yet been able to, because of their, you know, underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, have not been able to fully understand the consequences of their actions, the implications, the damage that they're doing.
Where are juveniles held who are either charged or convicted of murder?
That's a tricky question. If it's pretrial detention, but they're going to be tried as an adult, federal law says that they do need to be held separately from adults. And in some cases this happens, and in some cases it doesn't. And if the physical structure isn't set up so that they can hold juveniles separate in a separate facility than adults, they have to be separated by sight and sound. That is, they cannot commingle with the adults. Oftentimes this is also violated, and we know that because children are much more likely to be abused in adult facilities by adults. They're also much more likely to commit suicide, as much as 34 times more likely than the regular juvenile population. And they're denied many services. They are denied certainly age-appropriate services and programming that they direly need. They're also, you know, they're commingling often with seasoned criminals. And so that's really a teaching ground for them. Once they're convicted as an adult, they can be housed with adults because of their crime rather than their age. A judge may place them because of their, you know, physically very small or frail or whatever. They can serve some of their time in a juvenile facility. It's all sort of on a case-by-case basis. If states have what's called a blended sentence, they can serve part of their sentence in a juvenile facility and then be bumped into the adult facility when they turn 21. Sometimes when they're, if they're not behaving well in the juvenile facility, as sort of added punishment, they're moved to the adult facility.
That was Ashley Nellis of the Sentencing Project. Contact the group by calling area code 202-628-0871 or visit their website at sentencingproject.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.